Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted to have on the show today Philip Schultz. We'll be discussing Mr. Schultz's new book of poems, Failure, published by Harcourt. And first of all, Philip, thank you so much for appearing on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Failure is a collection of poems, and it's about a topic that probably we all know a lot about, but don't like to talk about a lot in polite company. But if you would, tell us how you came to decide on writing a collection about failure.
Well, it's an interesting story. I was writing a collection, and I had various poems, the miscellany. I was working on a long poem that was going to deal at least indirectly with 9/11, New York, and dogs. And I had lunch with a friend, and we were talking, and somehow our fathers came up, and I told him the story, which surprised me. I guess I was getting ready to deal more directly with the subject of my father's death, which, you know, he died bankrupt, and it was there was a lot of turmoil around it, and he told me about his father and how his father was a failure. And I don't think I ever had this conversation before. I don't know how freely I spoke about my past, but suddenly we were both discussing what it meant to us as sons. I was an only child, and he was one of two, the only son, and what it was like to go through that, and to also just live. In my case, my father had failed. And it was almost notorious for failing, for his business failures in upstate New York. So we were living under that. We're living in my mother's house. We somehow never managed to go off and get our own place. And walking back from that lunch, I was inspired. I felt that, you know, how many other sons and daughters are there out there who had this experience? I think the most meaningful thing to me is that it wasn't, it always felt very private and shameful, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly I felt that I wasn't alone. That's always a good feeling.
Yes.
And that maybe it would be of interest to others. And I think I go through that process before I'm ready to write anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home and I started a poem called The One Truth, which came out rather quickly for me. I mean, I revise a lot. And that poem led to another one on its heels immediately called Failure. And then I realized that other poems dealt with it also in the book, at least glancingly. And then when I went back and looked at my other work, there was always that subject matter, but it was never dealt with in a larger format. So I took out a number of the poems I was working on, and I concentrated on the sense of failure, and that helped me write the long poem, which I had been working on ever since 201, because that allowed me to deal with the revolutions of 1848, which was, in history, one of the largest failures ever.
Mm-hmm.
50 revolutions failed almost simultaneous around the world, all for the same reasons. And so I had a subject matter. And it helped me shape each poem and focus it. And I felt I was almost writing a book or a novel. And people are now telling me when they read it that they feel it reads that way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. There is that continuity and that feeling of theme and subject. It does read like that. You're right when you say that. And I thank you for writing about it, because I could tell you my story, and it involves a failure of my father as well. So I think it's probably more common than we realize.
Oh, my boy, isn't that something?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know something? It's interesting how many people are coming up to me and talking about their relationship with failure. I mean, everyone. I mean, my wife said it to me, and I couldn't get the line in a poem that worked, but she actually said, everyone thinks that they're a failure. The only people who don't I have to give her credit. That's a great line.
That is.
But it's, isn't this interesting? Mm-hmm. It is. I have one friend said he. I have to say, people admonished me. They told me not to call the book this. I've never been so violently opposed to any title I've come up with. And they, now that some of these same people have seen the book, they feel differently. But there's something, there's a triggering mechanism in the word itself. And one friend said that it was the great American taboo.
Yes.
And it really is, isn't it?
It is. And I think, great poetry involves the use of words, individual words. So I think the word failure is an excellent title for a book of poems, just because of the nature of the beast. So,
you know, my wife thought so, and I trust her opinion. And she was almost, and another friend who has since died. But I mean, I think everyone else thought it was a mistake because, you know, I would be feeding my critics, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
There was one review that came out in a newspaper in Salt Lake City. The title of the review was "Failure is Anything But."
Mm-hmm.
So they're using.
Yes. Yes.
My fear, of course, was that somebody would say, I did everything but leave out the adjective big.
Yeah.
You're almost asking for it.
Yes. And it also has a very attractive dust jacket.
I'm blessed with this, you know, I feel like this great poetry editor, Drenka Willen, who works very hard at selecting just the perfect cover.
Mm-hmm.
It is the perfect one because it mitigates the word and it lightens it a little and it shows you the kind of wry humor.
Yes.
The bent nail. And,
yes.
It's just the right tone to take.
Exactly. Well, Philip, if you would you read us the first poem? It's Sunday morning in early November.
I would very much like to. It's Sunday morning in early November, and there are a lot of leaves already. I could rake and get a head start. The boys' summer toys need to be put in the basement. I could clean it out or fix the broken storm window. When Eli gets home from Sunday school, I could take him fishing. I don't fish, but I could learn to. I could show him how much fun it is. We don't do as much as we used to. And my wife, there's so much I haven't told her lately about how quickly my soul is aging, how it feels like a basement I keep filling with everything I'm tired of surviving. I could take a walk with my wife and try to explain the ghosts I can't stop speaking to. Or I could read all those books piling up about the beginning of the end of understanding. Meanwhile, it's such a beautiful morning. The changing colors, the hypnotic light. I could sit by the window watching the leaves, which seem to know exactly how to fall from one moment to the next. Or I could lose everything and have to begin over again.
Thank you. When you place that poem at the start of the collection, when did you write that in terms of the collection, and why? What was your thought process to place that as the first poem?
I think I wrote it early on, and I was forever rewriting it. I hope it doesn't sound like that, but it was twice the length. There was a kind of wistfulness and this feeling I'm always suffering that I'm doing one thing and there's 10 other things I should be doing. And as you get older, the feeling, the wistfulness darkens around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was shaping the book, I realized that it implies the fear. It certainly suggests at the end the fear of losing everything, which is what is at the heart of failure. I think failure is a kind of, you know, there's a magnet. The great draw, the great attraction, terms of my own history, having seen this example of complete absolute failure and what it did to my mother and myself, and had to start all over again and dig out of a huge hole, we're left with debt and disgrace. I think I've carried this feeling around with me. So I wanted to, in the book, start with something that was personal about myself, since mm-hmm. my father's story is really what it is at the center of the book. I wanted to be able to talk about how this, in a non-dramatic way, affects the speaker, the persona I, who, you know, tells all the poems in the first half of the book, and then in the second half there's one long poem with a character, a nameless persona character.
And do you think, as Americans, do we view failure differently than the rest of the world, do you think?
Well, that's a great question. I wish we had an hour to discuss that alone. I mean, that is a marvelous question. And it would take chutzpah and presumption on my part to attempt to answer it. I think probably, especially with this administration and in these times, a lot of the world would say that, because, you know, failure is the other side of the coin of success.
Yes.
The American dream is supposed to be about success. And we all know, I mean, from Darwin on, that, you know, every species survives and learns how to adapt by having something like 95% of its members die. It's endless trial and error, and it fails over and over again before it learns how to adapt. And every poem that works, there's a, probably in my case, a good 10 to 15 that don't, and every poem that works is a good 100 drafts. It's endless trial and error. So there's something about this country and how we view success and the meaning of the American dream seems to imply that there is no process, that there's only success.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the rags-to-riches story, the Horatio Alger story, is really a story about you have to succeed to make your story worthy of being told.
Yes.
And it's the success part that matters.
Yes.
You know, we in every, it's a country of immigrants, and all the immigrants, we know about the ones who succeed in every family, but for every one who succeeded, there are probably hundreds who didn't.
Yes.
And they're not spoken about.
Mm-hmm.
And their contributions to the success of the few are never really celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
So, because of my own background, I've always had a special affinity for success.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for the idea of success and the other side of the coin, failure.
Mm-hmm.
So they to me, they go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Someone told me a couple months ago, an author I was interviewing, they said, you know, we're interested in how far people fall, but we're really interested in how far they bounce back. We like the bounce back part of the story, you know, better than the fall.
Well, that's sports, right?
Yes, yes.
That's Bill Clinton, the comeback kid.
Yes.
And as long as they bounce back, or as long as they were successful at one point, the idea of unadulterated failure is really not conscionable.
Right.
Is, you know, it's not palatable.
Yes.
It's the black sheep in every family. So I guess one of the ideas behind this was to celebrate failure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I hope I've done it in
yes.
a way. The character in the long poem at the end is nameless. I mean, he loves dogs. He wouldn't be seen as a success in any way. He loves dogs, but he can't bear to own one.
Mm-hmm.
He guy. He spends his time. He has the keys to much more the apartments of much more successful people because he has to pick up their dogs and take them for walks. He spends time walking around these larger, fancier places. And I don't think he sees himself as a failure.
Mm-hmm.
I think he loves dogs and enjoys his life for mm-hmm. what it is.
Yes, and those houses might be in foreclosure right now.
Poetic justice. I'm portraying my politics, I think.
Yes. Hey, Philip, let's have you read a poem which is a little lighter and involves children, which I particularly enjoyed, The Magic Kingdom.
Indeed. A friend told me that he just read, he has two sons also, and he just read this poem to his boys. And he wrote me an email. It's very moved by the fact. And, you know, The Magic Kingdom, of course, refers to Disneyland
mm-hmm.
and the whole fantasy of that, but in a different context.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful January Sunday morning, the first morning of the new year, and my old dogs limp behind me up the beach as my sons scour the ochre sand like archivists seeking the day's quota of mystery. To them, it's all a magical kingdom, their minds tiny oceans of good and evil strategies, the hard traffic of dreams closed by a flourishing expectation. We came here for the ripening light, the silence of the enormous sky, to exult in the shy jewels of sea glass polished by the tides of the wind. In the forlorn shrieks and chortling cries of gulls rising and falling between their world and ours, to be where it was lush, lonely, and secret enough. At the edge of things, in the shimmering spray and flawless sparkle of seashells, under the lonely momentum of clouds lugging their mysterious cargoes all the way to the horizon and back, each a wish, a gift that must be returned. I never thought I'd have so much to give up, that the view from this side of my life would be so precious. Bless these filaments of seagrass, this chorus of piping plovers and bickering wrens. Each mile these arthritic animals tag behind, sniffing tire ruts, frothy craters of rotting driftwood, lacy seaweed and scuttling crabs after something deliciously foul. Bless the plenitude of the suffering mind, its endless parade of disgrace, spider's web of fear, the hunger of the soul that expects to be despised and cast out, the unforgiving ghosts I visit late at night when only God is awake. Bless this ice-glazed garden of bleached stones strewn like tiny pieces of moonlight in sand puddles, the wind's grievous sigh, the sinking light, the salt, the salt. Most of all, bless these boys shivering in the chill light, their fragile smallness and strange intransigence, so curious and shining. Bless their believing happiness will make them happy, that the ocean is magical, a kingdom where we all go to be human and grateful.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Now, the third poem that I had asked you to read is a much darker poem, and when I read it, it was very haunting. And the poem is titled My Wife, and it seems like each word in each sentence in this poem has pain in it. And if you would discuss this poem a little bit. You can talk about it before or after you read it, whichever you prefer. But I found it to be very, very moving.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, the subject is pain, really. I mean, if I had to name one thing, I think that would be it. The word is used a number of times. It's about grief, of course, but it's also about pain, and surviving pain, use events that happen, but I'm using those events to build a kind of attitude toward the emotion that we have to find the strength to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to go on and read it now?
Please.
Okay. My wife. My wife's younger brother took heroin and died in the bed he slept in as a boy across the hall from the one she slept in as a girl. He sold the pot he grew in their basement. She left work to take him to the clinic, but she understood she had to save herself. No one saves themselves. Before I met my wife, I'd put on anything clean. My life dragged behind like a heavy shadow. I was resigned to anonymity. I wanted to sleep. She gave my pain a bride. 2 months after he died, we hold hands across the Black Sea, trying not to despise the drunk at the next table who doesn't even try not to listen. It's best not to think about the pain, to shut your eyes and float. Our kids were jumping on our bed, windmilling, in love with their capacity for delight. When she answered the phone, she shut her eyes. He was a sweet young man who looked, when we took him on his 30th birthday to a restaurant filled with beautiful women, as if he wanted to live forever. When we visited his grave, the kids and I wandered around in the city of the dead, and I could see her down the long avenues, pulling weeds, staring at the ground. At night, she walks in the dark downstairs. I know what she wants, to go to him the way she goes to our boys when they're frightened, to place herself between him and the pain.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you for reading that. Let's move on to the title poem of the collection, Failure. And this poem, I think, for when I read Failure, I loved the first line and I loved the last line. I thought it was a perfect bookend to the poem. And you said this was one of the first poems you wrote in the collection, or one that came to you fairly early on in the process.
Yes, I think it was. I think after this lunch, which was revelatory for me, I was very excited, and I went and I wrote The One Truth, the poem before Failure. And then I said, I don't think I had the title yet, but I you know, he uses the word, and it's at the heart of the other poem. So I then thought, well, why don't I write a poem
mm-hmm.
for Failure?
Mm-hmm.
Felt right. This would be a way of discussing it.
And Philip, do you think it's easy?
I had no idea. I knew it probably my father would have to do with the with the poem, but I had no idea what I was going to say or what exactly it was going to be about. And almost immediately, the first three lines of the first idea, the first sentence came, and then of course I knew what the poem was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was shocked,
mm-hmm.
frankly.
Do you think that
it's not something I probably admitted to friends, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I mean, yes, when my father died, he lost everything. And he didn't leave enough money. There was no money to bury him with. He didn't belong to a Jewish. He didn't belong to a synagogue. He didn't have a grave. There was no money to buy a casket. I was 18, and I had to go to a number of people. Some said no. And what I discovered is that they said no because he already owed them money. And that even though they cared for him and he was dead and it was a moment of grief, there was some resentment and bitterness. And I was confronted with that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not an easy thing to absorb. money to bury him.
Hmm.
Now, it's interesting for every man and woman, but certainly at this time, every man to ask himself what it would be like to actually leave people with no insurance or leave their family, and that must be the thing they would fear most.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Well, then, do you want me to read it?
Please.
Failure. To pay for my father's funeral, I borrowed money from people he already owed money to. One called him a nobody. No, I said, he was a failure. You can't remember a nobody's name. That's why they're called nobodies. Failures are unforgettable. The rabbi who read a stock eulogy about a man who didn't belong to or believe in anything was both a failure and a nobody. He failed to imagine the son and wife of the dead man being shamed by each word. To understand that not believing in or belonging to anything demanded a kind of faith and buoyancy. An uncle counting on his fingers my father's business failures, a parking lot that raised geese, a motel that raffled honeymoons, a bowling alley with roving mariachis, failed to love and honor his brother, who showed him how to whistle under covers, steal apples with his right or left hand. Indeed, my father was comical. His watches pinched. He tripped on his pant cuffs and snored loudly in movies, where his weariness overcame him, finally. He didn't believe in savings, insurance, newspapers, vegetables, good or evil, frailty, history, or God. Our family avoided us, fearing boils. I left town, but failed to get away.
Mm. Thank you. You know, Philip, as you were reading that, it really touched close to home. I lost my father when I was 18.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. In very similar circumstances as yours. And I think now I'm at a point in my life where, you know, I can look at my father and I can love him for what he was unable to do, with a much more open mind than I was when I was in my 30s or 40s.
And that's how old you were when your father... you say he was 18?
I was 18 when he died. I'm 50 now. So I can now look at his life with some empathy and compassion, which was very hard for me to do when I was a younger man.
Oh, it is. I mean, the anger that I lived with. Because you're not on flat ground. You're in a hole that you have to dig yourself out of.
Mm-hmm.
And people see you. It's like you're tainted. Did you feel that?
Oh, absolutely. We had a friend of our family. We were living in an apartment, and he paid 2 months' rent on our apartment so that we could stay there. And it was one of the most incredible acts of compassion that anyone's ever shown me.
Oh, my God. So you also lost your place.
Yes. Yes.
We had to move out a month after my father. Right. We didn't have money for rent.
Mm-hmm.
He left no insurance or anything.
Right. Right. And my father was an insurance agent.
Well, you know, the last time I had this conversation, I wrote this book. I pray to God I don't have to do it again.
Yes. Yes.
This is amazing.
Well, I think it's probably something that...
We know now why you chose this.
True. I was drawn to the subject matter. But I think that, you know, as we mature as people, I think that most of us, if we look at our families, probably all of us have some pretty serious cases of failure in our family without going out on the family limb too long.
Well, I mean, you know, to use my wife's line, we're all failures.
Yeah.
I mean, we succeed at some things and fail at many more others. life is a matter of to write a poem that's any good, you have to fail at it 100 times before you get anything right. At least
mm-hmm.
I do.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but I mean, finally, you look at. I mean, I guess if we're charitable and forgiving and compassionate, I mean, we look at ourselves and we are sympathetic. And if you're sympathetic, you look at what we've accomplished and what we've achieved, but with a good knowledge of the things we wanted to do and failed at.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, is anyone, you know, yes, I totally agree with what you said. I had to forgive my father and go through that whole process before I could write this book.
Yes.
I had to stop basically feeling like a failure before I could call it that or
yes.
write it.
Yes.
So you do have to evolve. You
yes.
You have to go through that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very large subject.
It is.
And I'm envious of you that you can. I'm 62, and I don't think at 50 I could have said what you just said.
Well, I mean, it's a fairly recent thing for me as well, so it's one of those things that I think my father was 46 when he died. I'm now older than my father was when he died. Hmm. And that's an interesting event in a person's life, I think.
Well, you just touched on something. My father was just, I think he died a month before his 60th birthday. And the poems in the book I began writing and working on when I, around exactly at that age.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I finished the poems when I was, I think, you know, well, 6 months ago or so. I kept writing and rewriting them right to the end. But it was when I was approaching the age he was when he died, it was a big moment for me,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. There must be a correlation there.
Yeah, and I think probably the idea of the book and this lunch all happened around that time, too.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Philip, let's talk about The Wandering Wingless, which is a large epic poem you've written, 54 pages long. And when I read your collection, The Holy Worm of Praise, you have a long poem in there, Souls Over Harlem, which I believe is 24 pages. And this is a long poem, and it's written in several parts. And you really bring in a cornucopia of subjects and topics into this poem, which I just loved. And if you would tell us a little bit about this, the final poem in the book.
Well, you know, the long poem in the book, The Holy Worm of Praise, Souls Over Harlem, I was working on that on and off for, you know, probably 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And fighting it and putting it aside and going back to it. And there was a long silence between books for me that lasted over 15 years for all kinds of reasons. But I always was working on that particular poem. That was a big subject. The last thing I wanted to do, again, was write a long poem, especially one longer than that. And I fought the idea. And I originally, you know, it's hard to be a writer and not have a response to 9/11, wrote a 3-page poem that became a 7-page poem about 9/11, and it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Failure keeps coming up, and I put it aside and wrote smaller poems, and they kept growing. And, dogs are a large part of, my wife and I met through our dogs, the dog run in New York. And we had a very small wedding, and our dogs gave us away, so they had little bow ties. I had a big black dog who wore a red bow tie, and ate the wedding license while during the ceremony.
That's funny.
They were a large part of our. So I tried to write a poem a poem about dogs and meeting in a dog run. It was even a short story at one point. And there were a number of things that I guess failed at, couldn't work at. And I had a poem that I've been working at for over 10 years. Called The Revolutions of 1848, based on this book I've always loved and the idea of all this failure. Now, I never knew why I was so fascinated by failure. So I didn't know why I was so fascinated by these revolutions, because mm-hmm. really it was 50 revolutions around the world, everywhere from South America to Russia to, of course, Hungary, England, France, mostly the sons of the aristocracy wanting to help the workers be more equal and wanting what America had based on our revolution and pushing things when the countries weren't ready and the people weren't ready you know, endless bloodshed all around the world, endless failure. All the changes they strived for came about naturally to 5-6 years later. In any case, I had all these different poems, all these different ideas, and also always wanted to write directly about what really happened to me during my father's failure. And I, one day, in the middle of the night, when often these things happen for me, I started to put all the different ideas and strands together. None of them worked on their own. And suddenly I had the 9/11 poem being not a subject but a context.
Mm-hmm.
And the revolutions of 1848 being a context, background. And it became, and the history that I always wanted to write about myself became this character.
Mm-hmm.
I, who wasn't me. The distance was what I needed, and I wove all these different stories together in an excited fashion. And it happened rather quickly. I mean, I needed to rewrite and polish it, but it probably in a period of 6 to 8 months, I had this poem. And the fact that it was growing and it was growing, I resigned myself to the fact it wasn't what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
There was no stopping it. It took on a life of its own. And I knew enough to know that when it does that, you just go with it.
Yes.
So that became the Wandering Wingless. The title comes from, I read somewhere that that there's a line in it. I mean, I could find that and read it to you. But that the ants are the only wingless insects. And there's this line, it's from section, may I read this?
Sure, absolutely.
The guy is in, he has a breakdown, and he's in a psych ward, and he's talking to a shrink. Last September, Dr. O asked if I wouldn't prefer to be a tad less obsessed with watching an exodus of imbecile ants inch across the voluptuous wilderness of my consciousness. With that being called quite so often to God's longest-running spectacle, the Wandering Wingless. And the ants are the wingless and the wandering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that line came to me long before, maybe 5 years before, I found the context and the place to use it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know, I'm. It's the wandering Jews. It's the wandering, and our self-absorption. The shrink is asking the character why he's so self-absorbed. Why is he watching ants on the ground? Why is he the ants of his own consciousness? I think we need something in our lives to remove our focus from ourselves and put it on something more worthy of our attention,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think, some people call reality or history or our lives or an external life. And for him, for this character, it's dogs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That seems to be the only thing that works for him.
Mm-hmm.
The dogs are his teachers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I love the epigraph that you have from Walker Percy. To become aware of the possibility of the search is to be on to something. Not to be on to something is to be in despair. And I love Walker Percy, and I love that quote that you use.
Well, you, once again, have put your finger on something. I mean, one of my favorite books, probably one of the books that made me want to be a writer, is The Moviegoer.
Mm-hmm.
And this eye, in many ways, is based on Bing Spalding, the character in The Walker.
Absolutely. Great novel.
I had to use it because I love his use of first person. I love that character. And he's always dealing with human frailty, his own vulnerability. He's an extremely vulnerable character. And he survives by taking care of someone else, his cousin, Kate. And I used this character for this eye. so, yes, I reread the novel, used the eye for this character. So you may have discovered that.
Well, it's for the listeners that have not read The Moviegoer by Walker Percy, highly recommended. Anything that Walker Percy wrote is worth reading, I think.
It's one of my favorite books. It probably, if I had to name five, it would definitely be one of them.
And for a first novel, it's just incredible that that was his first work of
fiction.
Well,
you know, it's a first novel, but he rewrote it over and over again. For at least 10 years, he had consumption, tuberculosis. He was a trained shrink, I think. He was a medical doctor.
Yes, he was.
I think becoming a psychiatrist. And he was in the hospital, and he just started writing it there. And it was turned down in various forms by every publisher in New York.
Yes, that's great story.
He finally found a way of mastering his story. He finally persisted and turned failure into success.
Mm-hmm. And won the National Book Award.
He did, for a first novel.
Yes.
But, you know, the work and the wisdom and the life and the intelligence that went into it would be equal to five someone's book.
Yes, I agree. I agree. Philip, would you read us a section of The Wandering Wingless?
Sure.
If you would, I marked section two, the first five stanzas.
Okay.
I like that section. Thought the listeners would enjoy hearing that.
Okay. One. Dogs by nature aren't spiteful. They don't hold grudges. We punish, elevate, and bully them as if they were us. But even we aren't us. Nobody is. We're all pack members, performing our variations of the howl of loneliness, pleading with our brothers and sisters to come join us in the song of the tribe. No one wants to live in the dark wood outside himself alone at night. A good walker knows to join in when a dog howls. Two. Quote, I lost my sweet pug Placebo yesterday, my colleague Lima is saying, while watching her client Percy, an argumentative golden. Mine is a boastful whippet named Balzac. Writers are in at the moment. I have a Gogol, a Homer, and two wolves. Cancer, she says. The owner told me not to come over, like she wasn't my dog, too. We only enlarge their grief, I think. Share your grief, and before you know it, you're drifting head over heels in impermeable darkness. We're all afraid of being swallowed. I'm so sorry, Lima, I say. Three. In my old neighborhood, everyone was afraid. The old houses were afraid of their attics and cold back rooms. The trees were afraid of the wind. Rusty wasn't afraid of anything. She would run alongside my bike. I tagged along, anonymous. When she disappeared, I looked for her in orchards, along streams and lakes, before and after school. Dad drove me to the farm where he had got her, but the lady said she hadn't seen her, but it was Sunday when everyone lies. Four. After Dad died, we moved back to Grandma's house in the city. Mother returned to her old job filing invoices, and I found work replacing DuPont's roof, along with 12 black men, not one of whom had ever worked with a white boy before. During lunch, I read about the revolutions of 1848. Because I hadn't yet graduated from high school and was fascinated by Prince Clemens Metternich's views on secret societies, class consciousness, the dreams of Parisian sewer workers, Italian patriots, and Viennese students, and all the idealistic sons of the aristocracy who, with jailed wood workers for whose sake they had started 50 ferocious revolutions, hurling violence upon cruelty, could find only the words to say, "Good morning, good evening, and it looks like rain." I read about it on the bus going to work at 4 a.m., sitting off by myself during lunch, trying to breathe through the black fog of boiling hot pitch, and at night while Mother cried in her room beyond the sliding curtain at the far end of the cosmos.
Thank you.
First four sections you want.
Yes, that's great.
You've been listening to The Casey Coars Show, A Celebration of Words. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for upcoming interviews.